This is WCRS 98.3, 102.1. And this is Fight Back with Bob Fetrakis and Connie Goodell-Newton.
We're continuing our conversation with Jerry Bello, anti-racist action activist. And we noted in the first segment that aired last week that Ohio seems to play prominently in a lot of this.
Well, let's be fair to Indiana and Michigan. They do their lifting too.
But I'm thinking with the keyholes and, you know, Commander Pedro and the Aryan Republican Army, and of course their popular nickname, which I always thought, which the Dispatch referred to them, the Midwest Bank Bandits. I thought it was because they didn't want people to know what they really were, an armed group of bank robbers that were neo-Nazis.
I mean, that was really clear. We don't, just like today, nobody wants to mention Tim McVeigh's very clear white supremacist ties. I mean, Tim McVeigh lived at a white supremacist compound in Oklahoma called Elohim City.
Whose great leader was martyred, wasn't it?
It wasn't one of their great leaders, but one of the people that lived there was executed for the murder of an Oklahoma police officer the day of the Oklahoma City bombing. And said, as his last words, "Y'all gonna pay for this." And then 3 hours later, Tim McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma City building.
That's interesting.
And the people from Elohim City went to the prison and took his stinking carcass back from the prison and buried him at Elohim City, where Tim McVeigh used to live. Jeez. One would think that the press would seize upon this and be willing, you know, but Tim McVeigh and Terry Nichols are lone wing nuts as opposed to part of a cell, and nobody wants to say, look, there was an armed, organized, neo-Nazi guerrilla group operating for several years in the United States.
With a lot of money, because they robbed 22 banks in the Midwest.
Yeah, with a lot of money, and wow, they were dealing guns. Right, and a lot of guns, dealing in gold, some of which they stole from murdering gun dealers. I mean, these were real outlaws that were making real money and using it to finance the movement. You'd think it would be a great story that the press would seize upon, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. But they didn't, because we'd rather have, in America, we'd rather have a lone gunman narrative, that kind of narrative, the loner narrative about somebody, than admit that we have any kind of political movement of any flavor that's got any kind of gripe with society. It's the same thing as calling a neo-Nazi or dismissing racism as ignorance.
Yeah, you really see a lot of sanitizing in the press.
Well, Pierce was not an ignorant man. He was well educated, was he not?
He was a damn smart adversary, and I am thankful that he is dead. I'm very, very, I threw a big party the day he died. Because my life got a whole lot easier because that man was damn dangerous.
So is it fair to call the Ku Klux Klan the longest-standing terrorist organization in U.S. history?
Sure.
And why is it so long-standing if you're so obsessed with Al-Qaeda and other... I defer to Mark Twain, right? That's America's only indigenous criminal class.
It's true.
But this is an actual terrorist group. I mean, Congress has the joys of actually passing laws that makes their activities legal. The Klan doesn't care about legalities. I mean, they kill people, they terrorize people, and they have, you know, since the Civil War.
Yes, they're America's, well, you can't call them America's longest standing Klan terrorist organization, because the Klan, you know, it's not like they're the IRA, where there's a direct organizational lineage that you can trace them from. You can trace any given clan from, you know, Nathaniel Bedford Forrest's backyard to somebody else's backyard here, where you have an unbroken lineage of leaders, the clan's whole clan whole organizations that who have called themselves the clan have risen, fallen, folded, had corporate existences, and stopped over the last 150 years. There's no unbroken history of the clan in any one place, even if a little phlegm droplet of it has existed here or there for, you know, long. There's no national long-standing clan that's existed forever and ever and ever and ever. The clan as an idea definitely is America's longest standing terrorist organization, but we have to go further and realize that these systems of oppression can't be held in place just by law. You know, they have to be held in place by extra legal terror. And they serve a purpose that benefits people, and it's not just ignorance, it's a way to sanitize it. It's a way to deny mainstream America's responsibility for it.
Well, by mainstream in the South, I mean, it was the power structure. I mean, all the reports were that the reason you got elected county sheriff is because you had a confirmed kill of a black man. And the coroner, of course, who could have a inquest of the sheriff, had to be, you know, a Klan member and a doctor. And a lot of law enforcement itself. But not only that, on top of it, you had the wealthy business people, right? The white citizens, consuls, that seemed to direct the Klan as to its target. So you've got the wealthiest people in the towns throughout the South turning the Klan loose on its perceived enemies.
There's that, but let's talk about now, today, right? Where clearly America does not have its race issues worked out. And by pushing off the race issues on neo-Nazi groups and then saying that they're ignorant, right?
It seems like a convenient scapegoat for everybody who's maybe participating or benefiting, for a lot of white people who are benefiting from a racist system, to say, like, oh, well, you know, there are these white people over here who are super racist and ignorant, and I'm not doing that stuff.
And small and marginal and not a threat. When in reality, if you look at the dynamic of fascist movements, I mean, they're not so much a danger. I mean, they're a danger to minorities, no doubt, but the first thing that they have to do, their first mission, is the conquest of political power and the elimination of any and all progressive forces in society. They have to, and to prove their worth, they have to physically destroy the left to gain the freedom to really destroy everything that they really want to destroy.
But aren't they fundamentally a nationalist movement? And how do they differ from other nationalist movement? Mussolini, Hitler, above all else, are nationalists. And don't they thrive in part because the nation isn't doing well and we're not taking care of our workers and there is record foreclosures?
Absolutely. That definitely feeds it. And that's definitely helpful. And there's, in the case of Germany, unaddressed national aspirations. That's not gonna sell so much in America. America's definitely had its national aspirations. America is definitely not going to perceive itself as the victim of an unfair treaty that ends a war, that ends a very destructive war, you know, that's just killed 10 million terrified teenagers all over Europe. Right, that's not going to happen to America. So the economy is definitely a key, but when, and nationalism needs to find an internal enemy to focus anger on before it can focus militarism outwards, right? And it needs to, it's different than normal capitalism, where normal capitalism exploits the workers. fascism physically consumes them.
How so? How do you mean
physically consumes them, works people to death.
Okay.
Right?
Gives them cancer.
No, I mean death in factories. Well, if you look at beyond the Holocaust that, came very close to eliminating...
Mm-hmm. Genocide.
The genocide of Jewish people and Romani people in Europe. Beyond that dimension, right, millions of people died. Millions of French and Dutch and Belgian and Russian and Lithuanian. People of all the countries that, Germany conquered, it requisitioned workers from those countries, brought them to Germany, forced them to work in the fields and in the factories, Poles, and worked, many of them subjected them to substandard living conditions, right? Put them in the factories that the Allies were most likely to bomb, and quite a lot of those people died, right? And that has two functions. It physically consumed that labor force. Those people are dead.
Yeah.
And two, the amount of people that trend, the amount of foreign slave laborers, non-Jewish foreign slave laborers working in Germany during the war, was almost exactly equal over the course of the war to the size of the military formations of the SS.
Okay.
In other words, the exact amount of people where German industry, by the end of the war... The German worker was a very thin line of management and foremanship over a vast system of foreign workers that were doing the really, really nasty hard labor, where to create this class of warriors, these SS people, not the regular German army, right, to create this special class of political fascist warriors, you need to free them from working and to support them in their conquests. You need to work the people that you have working can't be provided for and must be worked to death. That's the logic of it. And that's where fascism isn't, we say fascist to say bad. Or really bad. Yeah. Fascism is different. It literally physically consumes segments of the society.
It sounds like a machine that just chews people up and spits them out, basically. So how do we see that in the United States, mirrored in the United States, the fascist elements here? I mean, it seems like there are some elements of that in the way we treat workers. And,
to a degree, but there's a totality to it. There's a level of extra legal violence to it that we can't. We're not being fair to ourselves or honest with ourselves to make that comparison.
Okay.
As bad as American society is and as many problems as we have.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the prison industrial complex and the great number
25% of all prisoners on planet Earth are here. Disproportionately people of color.
And they do work.
What about Bertrand Gross? He says it's friendly fascism. There's a prison industrial complex. There's a military industrial complex. There's a security industrial complex.
We
learned to do it with smiley faces.
Undocumented workers that employers aren't paying taxes for.
Instead of nasty, direct repression. I mean, we have the largest spy at $50 billion known dollars a year. 80% of it used on our own citizens with no probable cause. Isn't that fascism, Jerry?
No, I mean, it's bad, and it's very bad, but it's not fascism. The reality of the situation is
okay, why isn't it fascist if you can attack a country, wage aggressive war that Nazi generals were hung for? You can attack a country that's not a threat to Iraq, under violating the Nuremberg principles, which condemned Nazis and fascists, and there's no accountability. There's no accountability for that action. Isn't that fascism?
No, it's not. Because
we can talk about it on the radio.
Here's
the thing. And no one knocks on the door and takes us away.
No, what do you mean knocks on the door? They don't knock. They just come, right? No one knocks on the door. We're not worried. I mean, I was followed by, by undercover security goons in the course of my activism today. I was followed by an FBI agent today. But you know what? The person driving my car got a traffic ticket, right? They didn't come here. They didn't kick the door down.
But in the past, you said they beat you for stuff that was minor.
Yes.
In the past, I've been maced. I've been attacked. I mean.
Yeah. The thing is, and I'm sure they'd like to do it again, and I'm sure I'm going to get my butt whooped again at some juncture, right? And yes, it's bad, and there's elements of it, but it's not omnipresent. You know, that level of repression is not omnipresent, systematic.
Because they haven't been able to eliminate the left
entirely.
Progressive forces, and also we have a very militant black population that is going to go down swinging, unlike the Jews in Germany.
Well, and frankly speaking,
that's awesome.
and frankly speaking, thankfully, we can thank the right wing for one thing:
arming us.
American society's armed to the teeth. And so, kicking the door, going around kicking the door in because you don't like what somebody has to say, gets unhealthy.
Led to huge riots, which are very unproductive in the 1960s.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is we're discussing, it's not fascism. We're discussing this here without any fear that somebody's going to stop us from talking, right? That there's going to be a single extra legal repercussion for anything that we've said. I've talked about policemen beating me, in a paddy wagon, and I am not going to suffer for that. I can do that openly without fear.
But you still had a policeman beating you in a paddy wagon, which sounds...
Well, guess what? It's a done deal. It's like, me talking about it is not going to make me unhit, but I'm not going to get my butt whooped specifically because I talked about it again 15 years later. That's just not the case. And as bad as the situation in America is and getting worse... thank you, Obama, but you still haven't closed Gitmo yet. Anytime you want to get around to that, that'd be great. I'm not going to hold my breath and say hope change until somebody gets a job. But as bad as the situation is, and it's getting worse, we're not there yet. And there's not, right now, a massive, organized groundswell of support where people... aren't just asking the government, run the undocumented workers out. They're going and hanging them until they leave. That's the difference between what we have and fascism. Now, Arizona's getting mighty close. And that's the hallmark of the 21st century is these social phenomenon, this repression is going to happen over more and more uneven terrain. And then the one place where I would say that we're getting close is exactly in how we treat the undocumented in this country, exactly because the laws that we're passing and the attitudes that we're having are not designed to eliminate undocumented workers. They're designed to make sure that the only place that undocumented workers will work or will be able to work are in large groups where you can concentrate the repression and separate them from society, separate them from oversight, and separate them from the legal means for dealing with that repression where they can be worked to death on secluded farms and no one will ever know or look. Where you can create really slave labor conditions, right? That's the real goal is not to eliminate them or to eliminate them economically from the economy, but to force their wages even further lower, keep them at just the right amount, and frankly speaking, create jobs for white men, repressing them, documenting them, catching them, deporting them, you know, guarding the border and murdering them in the desert and now calling it legal. These are the things that they'd like to do, and that's where we're getting close, and that's sort of the edge. And that's the one thing that, you know, Ohio's not yet on the front line, although as much as there's a groundswell of support where they'd like to be. And that's where we're not as bad as the prison industrial complex is. It's not a winner. It's not economically unviable. They haven't, you know, and as they haven't been able to make a prison factory in America that is really super profitable, or we'd see even more of them. I'm sure they'd like to be able to do that. They haven't figured it out yet, and let's not go ahead and encourage them. And so, thankfully, they've created, with the prison industrial complex, a situation that's ultimately not sustainable for them. And it's going to have to erode and step back eventually. They're going to have to move all the people that they've devoted to operating these prisons, you know, that segment of the military class, to other work eventually.
Well, if it's costing you $30,000 to $35,000 a year to lock up people, many of those, you know, small-time drug consumers and people that are nonviolent criminals, it can't inherently be viable, can it?
No, it can, especially if you can't derive $30,000 to $50,000 of profit per person, which you cannot.
But isn't the prison system itself one of the great incubators of white supremacy, the Aryan Brotherhood?
No. I mean, everybody talks about the Aryan Brotherhood or white supremacist prison gangs. And these things exist. But we don't see, and I, with some notable exceptions, like that King guy down in Texas. But you don't see white men going into prison, not political, joining the Aryan Brotherhood, and coming out political activists for white supremacy. You don't see people really sticking with the Aryan Brotherhood behind the prison walls. You don't see them as, I mean, if they were in politics, not as many of them, frankly speaking, would be in prison. They're, you know, the Aryan Brotherhood is a whites-only criminal organization with very little reach outside of the prison.
What about
and most of these people put it down once they leave, and the ones that don't stay in it for the criminal and profit aspects, not for the racial and political aspects of what it offers them.
But aren't there some ties then with the racist to the so-called motorcycle gangs? The
yes.
White, I mean, in Brightmoor in Detroit, it looks like the only whites that are left in that part of the city are all affiliated in many cases with motorcycle gangs, and sometimes those gangs are affiliated with Nazi literature.
I mean, there's
Nazi symbolism.
There's organic, long-term, ongoing connections in the Midwest between the Outlaws Motorcycle Club and various neo-Nazi organizations. And, you know, the Outlaw Motorcycle Club is definitely a criminal organization, and it definitely has reach inside of prisons. But to say that the Aryan Brotherhood is a great incubator for neo-Nazi organizations everywhere, and it's producing the troops for the race war, I don't see that happening. I see white supremacist members of white supremacist skinhead organizations who wind up in prison. Yeah, they may be somewhat involved with the Aryan Brotherhood or with other gangs, but they'll hang with their own more political people in prison and then move back into politics or quit politics and move into crime. And with neo-Nazi organizations, you know, the lines blurred, but, you know, there's an amount of focus and concentration that goes with everything.
Okay. The question then is, why should we fight these groups if they're not a, if we don't see them as a great threat? Why don't we just leave them alone? I mean, are the anti, is the Aryan Nation really going to recruit enough people to do much damage?
If we ignore it, will it just go away?
I don't know. Is that a really small lump on your skin? Are you going to give it a biopsy or not?
And what about, you talked about some of Pierce's works, but what about the shooter? What about other theories that it doesn't take that many white supremacists to start a race war? In fact, a handful, if they were willing to shoot Ricky Birdsong in the back or go to, you know, into an Indiana college and shoot someone who's Asian, or go out in California and shoot a Filipino, you know, mailman, can't that strategy work?
Then why didn't it?
Well, because I think the government actually acted somewhat to stop it.
Well, I mean, but here's the thing. It didn't. The fact that Ricky Birdsong was shot by a neo-Nazi following William Pierce's writings didn't have the public resonance that, frankly speaking, made a bunch of people angry. And the white supremacist that shot Ricky Birdsong didn't even know he was shooting Ricky Birdsong. He was shooting a random black jogger who happened to be a famous basketball coach. You know, that doesn't work. You can't, you know, a race war isn't going to start in America because some white supremacist terrorist cell creates a bunch of atrocities and then black people get mad and decide to fly off the handle and kill all white people, and then all of a sudden that's not going to work for them. These people have to build that might create tension, but these people have to build organizations that are capable of seizing power, that are capable of violently remaking society in their image, and they have to do it from the ground up. Why it's important to fight them is, one, it limits their power, and it increases ours. If we can deal with them, then we're not going to be threatened on a labor picket line. We're not going to tolerate environmental degradation. We're not going to be bullied out of our reproductive rights. We're not going to have religion jammed down our throats in public schools, because we're not going to be intimidated, because we've overcome what Trotsky called the traditional flabby pacifism of the left.
I just want to send a shout out to my neighborhood, Wineland Park. It's an awesome neighborhood that has a lot of black families and a great neighborhood school, good community organizations. It's where the Spore and the Third Hand Bike Co-op and Airwax City Gardens are located. And I'd just like to... I'd like to encourage listeners to visit the Bike Co-op, and just want to send out a shout out to my awesome, wonderful neighbors in Wineland Park. This has been Fight Back with Bob Fetrakis and Connie Goodell Newton. Jerry, thank you so much for visiting with us and
it's always
talking
a pleasure
on our show. This is WCRS 98.3, 102.1.
And this is Dr. Bob Fetrakis. Glad to be talking about how to fight fascism in America.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you again on behalf of myself, my friends, and the wonderful people in Columbus who come from many backgrounds.